From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The sixth and latest Harry Potter book flew off the shelves this weekend. Harry Potter is growing up and facing challenges much bigger than staying on his broomstick. He's got girl issues, he's coming into his own as a full-blown wizard, and then there's the evil Voldemort. Harry Potter sells like hotcakes and has always been a good yarn, but is it becoming more than that? Some scholars have snubbed author J.K. Rowling. Others have put her on a pedestal next to J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. Some have scanned the Potter books and moved on. Others have lingered between the lines for the philosophy and worldview in Rowling's super popular work. So tonight we're off to the land of magic and wizards, but also good and evil, love and loss. This hour On Point, Harry Potter's place in literature and the worldview of J.K. Rowling. We begin with one take on the Harry Potter series. Jonathan Last is an editor at the Weekly Standard and wrote last week in the Wall Street Journal that he sees 1930s England between the covers of Harry Potter now. I asked him where he finds the historical allegory.
Sometimes you find historical allegory in the most unlikely places. The Harry Potter series started off as really a bunch of children's detective stories, sort of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys mixed with Dungeons and Dragons. But by the fifth book, it had turned into something really quite unexpected, which is a very detailed and complicated allegory of 1930s England.
1930s England, that being England between the wars, England moving toward World War II. At least you see that in the book.
That's right, and maybe I'm crazy, but it tracks so nicely with the second volume of William Manchester's really magisterial biography of Winston Churchill, where you really see what's happening to England in these interwar years. And so many of the characters in the Harry Potter books wind up taking on the character of people we saw in 1930s England. You have Albus Dumbledore, who is the headmaster of Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
Yes.
And he is a very Churchillian figure. He stands up and he speaks the truth about the coming menace, who is Lord Voldemort. For this, he is roundly ridiculed and he loses much of his status and standing within the wizarding community, much the same way Churchill did when he cried, you know, from really whatever perch he could for almost 10 years, about the coming threat that he saw gathering in Nazi Germany.
So you see in Dumbledore a Churchill, not the same pugnacity in the way he's presented, at least as personified in the film.
No, he's much more a much more polite Churchill than Churchill was, but he is tenacious and he does come with all of the deep wells of respect and age that Churchill had at the time. I mean, Churchill was already considered an elder statesman, somebody who had achieved whatever he was going to achieve and was past his prime and just waiting his years out.
All right, so the allegory here is you see Dumbledore as Churchill, you look across the good and evil line and there's Voldemort, who of course in this case must be.
And Voldemort is obviously Hitler. What's so funny is, you know, any series, be it Star Wars or Harry Potter, you can find someone who's evil enough that you say, well, he's just Hitler. What is interesting and what was unexpected with this series that the author, J.K. Rowling, brought us along. At first, we know that Voldemort is just bad guy, capital B, and that he wants to take over the world. For what purposes, we're not sure. But as the series has gone along, we've learned that all of this is motivated by racial animus. In the wizarding world of Harry Potter, you have pure-blood wizards, which are wizards born from other wizard parents, and you have mudbloods, which are wizards born from a normal or a muggle parent mixed with a wizard parent.
And there's a kind of ethnic cleansing agenda.
Exactly.
That Voldemort
this is
has.
Really the only real key to the Voldemort agenda, if you will, is that he wants to cleanse the entire wizarding world of these muggle-borns and these mudbloods and get rid of them. He is obsessed and fanatical about it.
Now, your allegory, as you interpret it, doesn't stop there. You've got a Neville Chamberlain stand-in. You say the Potter books, Cornelius Fudge could be his grandson. Give us your reading.
Cornelius Fudge, who is the Prime Minister of Magic, or the Minister of Magic in the Harry Potter series, is so much like Neville Chamberlain. He's a political master on the domestic front, and he's concerned with nothing so much as retaining power. But he's tone-deaf and will not hear of the coming threat with Voldemort. He pretends that Voldemort doesn't exist. He says Voldemort is dead. Anybody who says otherwise is just making things up and is crazy. And he suspects that Dumbledore, in propagating all of this information, is trying to take his post, which is what Chamberlain thought of Churchill when Churchill was talking about Germany back then. But at the same time, he's not a weak figure either. Fudge is, he's always very certain of himself. He plays real political hardball, much the same way Chamberlain does. And he surrounds himself with lackeys who are, again, interested in sucking up to his power and who are very, very abusive of any who oppose him.
And as you describe it, also leans on a kind of ever-present desire in a large community to deny or look away from a menace.
What we're told is that there had been another war with Voldemort 16 years ago in the Harry Potter series. In fact, the Harry Potter series, book one, in the prelude, it begins on the night that that war ends, when Voldemort is vanquished and people think is killed. But throughout all the Wizarding, we always see the weariness of the wizards in the Harry Potter world from this war. They still, 16 years later, have not put themselves back together again from what we were told was a very, very difficult and bloody conflict.
So, Jonathan, all of this you essentially drew from Book 5. That was Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. And now we've got Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Were you lined up at midnight? Do you have your copy? Are you plunging forward? Is the allegory holding up?
Well, I was lined up at 8 o'clock. I was lined up 4 hours before midnight, and it was just a wonderful event. I was very happy. My wife and I are now about 135 pages into it, and we're trying so hard to ration it.
I don't want to be too personal, but how old are you, and how do you feel about taking all this pleasure from a children's book?
You know what? I'm too old to be enjoying it, but you don't feel bad when you go to these Harry Potter parties
right.
And you see that really it is across the spectrum. You see parents who probably started reading these books when their children were children, and
yeah.
Now 10 years into the series, their children no longer need to read it, but the children are there anyway because they've grown up with them and the parents are reading it on their own.
The parents are hooked too. And let me just ask you about you're an editor at the Weekly Standard, conservative publication. How do you read the politics of this? It sounds like making a hero of Churchill would line up with your politics fairly well.
I don't know that there's any politics to it. Who knows where J.K. Rowling's politics are? If I had to guess, I'd say, well, she's European. They're probably off to the left of most of America. But what you're seeing here is an English historical understanding of these things. And so I think in a lot of ways that's apolitical. This is someone who is looking back, and my guess is drawing on what they learned in history class about how that period in English history unfolded.
Well, if you're right, a great war looms ahead. Who's Harry Potter in this allegory?
Well, who knows? And it could be that Miss Rowling lets this thread slip and moves on to other things in the new book. But I have suspected since I finished reading Book 5 that it could be Harry Potter will come to be FDR's America. That he was responsible for the vanquishing of Voldemort the first time, in much the same way America came in and tipped the balance of World War I. But now he's growing up, and he's a very powerful wizard, but he doesn't actually understand his power, and he's still learning and feeling his way. And Dumbledore has really cultivated his friendship with him in the same way that Churchill really cultivated Roosevelt in their relationship, and they became very close allies. And ultimately it was FDR and America which tipped the balance in World War II again, and I suspect that that may be where we're heading now.
Jonathan Last, it's a great reading, and you've got us off and running thinking about what's going on behind the line-by-line reading here. We appreciate your time with us. Enjoy the rest of the book.
Thank you. You too.
Jonathan Last is an editor at the Weekly Standard. He spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the Harry Potter saga and the worldview of J.K. Rowling. We'll hear in a moment from scholars tracking Harry Potter as literature and philosophy. But first, a quick look at the phenomenal sales of the latest installment, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Carol Nemet is a book critic at USA Today and joins me now from Washington. Carol, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So you write that they put out a record number of books in their initial printing, 10.8 million, and already that wasn't enough.
Right. Very few books, if any, other than this series, have crossed over from merely being a bestseller to being a record-breaking worldwide phenomenon. And no other book in history has ever had a first printing of 10.8 million copies. And over the weekend, the first 24 hours, the book was on sale. 6.9 million copies were sold in the U.S., and Scholastic, J.K. Rowling's U.S. publisher, has now gone back to print an additional 2.7 million copies, and I'm sure there'll be more reprints as the weeks go by.
Has any other book come close to this, or is it a class of its own?
It's in a class completely by itself. Very few books are this phenomenal. The only one that comes to mind, and it doesn't even come close, would be The Da Vinci Code. And what sets the Harry Potter books apart is that they're for people of all ages.
And what about the retailers who sell it? Can you give us some examples of what went on this weekend? It was mayhem at some of these stores.
Right. Bookstores have been kind of nervous in the last few years because consumer dollars have had to be spread amongst DVDs and CDs and video games and movie tickets. And so bookstores are now seeing that if they can turn things into events, they can draw a lot more people into their stores. But the books in themselves are wonderful and in a way sell themselves, but they are backed up by a seemingly simple but very ingenious marketing campaign.
And that being, what's the outline of it?
Well, I call it the kid in the candy store approach. You show a child a picture of his or her favorite candy bar, and in this case, a picture of the cover of their favorite book, and then you hint at its mysteries and all the suspense and adventure, but you say, sorry, you can't see this book until July 16th.
Right.
And then you up the ante by telling these kids who are 11 and 12 and 13 years old that you're going to have to go out of your house at midnight and buy this book at a bookstore, and it's just completely irresistible.
Now, that's exciting, and you get in almost a kind of magic mania for the magic going
right
there.
Well, and it's something that families share together, too, which is also very exciting, because at these midnight parties, not only do the kids dress up, but the parents dress up as well as characters from the books, and they feel that they're sharing an historical event with their children.
Well, we saw it Friday night right across the country, and it continues to go on. Carol Memet with USA Today, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
We are talking tonight about the Harry Potter saga and the worldview of J.K. Rowling. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is J.K. Rowling the new C.S. Lewis, the new chronicler of good and evil in the land of fantasy? We're at the 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Harry Potter saga, about Harry Potter's place in English literature and the worldview of J.K. Rowling unfolding now in volume number 6 of Harry Potter, a huge bestseller. It really goes beyond bestseller. It's a phenomenon in the United States and around the world. Welcome your questions tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. What do you think? Is this the new Lord of the Rings, the new Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, or is this the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew with broomsticks? What's the fundamental view of the world that comes through the pages of Harry Potter? What's the set of values and assumptions that millions of kids are learning from J.K. Rowling? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. Just to get in the groove here, let's listen a bit to a clip from the film version of the first Harry Potter book, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Here's Hagrid, the giant, when he first tells Harry that the young wizard has magical powers.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard. And a thumping good one, I'd wager, once you trade up a little.
No, you've made a mistake. I mean, I can't be a wizard. I mean, I'm just Harry.
Just Harry Potter, a worldwide publishing phenomenon, and in the minds of many young readers, increasingly more than that. We're looking tonight at what scholars think about this book and the series. We're joined right now from Dedham, Massachusetts, by Michael Drought. He's professor of English literature at Wheaton College. He is editing a J.R.R. Tolkien encyclopedia. He's editor of the Journal of Tolkien Studies. Michael Drought, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And with us tonight from Palo Alto, California, Seth Lehrer, professor of English at Stanford University. He is writing a history of children's literature and teaches a class on the subject. Seth, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Michael Drought, to you first, what do you see at this point? We've got volume number 6 out now. You've got bazillions of readers around the world. As literature, what do you see in J.K. Rowling's work? Is this in the tier of C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, however you place that tier?
I wouldn't raise it quite to the level of the two, I think, the best fantasists, Tolkien and Ursula Le Guin, but I would put it firmly in the second tier with C.S. Lewis's Narnia books.
Ursula Le Guin, I'm not familiar with. Tell me, remind us.
She wrote The Wizard of Earthsea, The Tombs of Etuan, The Farthest Shore, Tehanu, a whole series of books set in a secondary world called Earthsea. And in my opinion, those are the only ones that stand up to Tolkien in terms of sheer vastness of creation and consistency and integrity of the world.
So you're looking at this with that kind of measuring stick, vastness of creation, consistency and integrity of this alternate world. You're really looking at it, judging it by the quality and magnitude of the fantasy described.
Yes, fantasy, I think, needs to be judged more in the realm of the conception, the ideas, the images that you get, rather than in sort of modernistic terms, which would be in terms of the realism, the accuracy of the dialogue, the insight into human interpersonal relationships. That's not what fantasy is aiming for.
Seth Lehrer, there's a kind of measure, looking at this along the sort of yardstick of the magnitude of fantasy. C.S. Lewis is often described as a kind of moral teacher, with very often described as embedding all kinds of Christian metaphor and almost teaching in his work. How do you see Rowling in those terms?
Well, I think Rowling is really, for me, more akin to Dickens than to Tolkien or to Lewis, even though there are the fantasy elements in the book. What I see emerging is a real sensibility about what it means to write a novel, the sense that you have in Dickens of the young boy at school, of the minor character, of the texture of the sentence. And so, you know, I would like people to think about Rowling really in terms of some of the great novels of growth that we've grown up with, things like Great Expectations, or even something like Gulliver's Travels or Robinson Crusoe.
And, you know, a lot of people read Harry Potter with pleasure, but also kind of among adults, a kind of guilty pleasure, thinking, well, this isn't literature, for heaven's sakes. It's a kind of a child's tale that's been spun on and on. Do you put it really in the ranks of Dickens, or is it simply in that motif?
Well, first of all, none of my pleasures are guilty.
Good for you.
And second of all, I think that what she's trying to do, as the books have developed, is really move towards the creation of a kind of world that the great 19th century novelists created. I mean, for me, the real heart of these books is in the minor characters. A character like Snape, for me, is a character right out of Charles Dickens.
Snape being the dark, I forget now, it's been a while since I was reading these to kids, but a professor of potions or dark
That's
arts
right.
or something.
He's the Alan Rickman character in the movie. And, I mean, the very name, the very, you know, serpentine quality of that name, you know. And so many of the names in the book, Draco Malfoy, Dumbledore, are so evocative of the characters and caricatures of 19th century fiction.
Michael Drout, when you put J.K. Rowling's work, Harry Potter, in the same kind of tier and bucket as C.S. Lewis, what do your fellow scholars say to you? Do they say you're dreaming, you're crazy, or sure, it belongs there?
Well, I think most of my fellow scholars, with the exception of Professor Lehrer, would say, yes, they all belong in the same bucket, and it's a bucket off to the side rather than with serious literature. I think that's starting to change as new scholarly generations come along. But Lewis is really mostly only studied among Christian scholars, as you mentioned. He's very big, and there's some really excellent, at the other Wheaton College, actually, at the Christian Wheaton College in Illinois, who study Lewis in great detail. I think one of the things that Rowling does so differently from Lewis and Tolkien and Le Guin is, and it connects with Professor Lehrer's point about Dickens, is she brings humor to the fantasy genre, which,
sure.
I mean, Terry Pratchett, sure, he makes fun of the whole thing, but in terms of having a serious story and also being funny at the same time, I mean, that's Rowling's real contribution and real genius to it. Things like Diagon Alley, where they go shopping for all their school supplies every year.
Right, for wands and all the rest.
And it's funny, and it plays off of things in the primary world. You know, going back to school shopping, and instead of getting, you know, a pencil case, you have to get
right.
a cauldron
right.
or something like that.
Right.
And yet it has, like I said, it's an integrity, a consistency of vision where she's trying to make it all fit together, and she's not looking down on her fantasy world.
And let me ask you, you teach it at a Christian college at Wheaton?
No, I don't. I teach it at the one that used to be an all-women school.
That's right. The one in Illinois, that's right, is the Christian college.
Right.
Well, perhaps you can help us anyway. I'm looking here at a letter written by Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, now, of course, the Pope, to a critic of Harry Potter, a German critic of Harry Potter. And he says he's so glad that this critic is going after Harry Potter. He says, "It's good that you enlighten people about Harry Potter, because those are subtle seductions which act unnoticed and by this deeply distort Christianity in the soul before it can grow properly." Here's before he became the Pope. But nevertheless, Cardinal Ratzinger attacking Harry Potter on religious grounds. I don't know if C.S. Lewis came in for that kind of attack from established religion, but what do you make of that, Michael Drout?
Well, I think that fantasy tends to get hammered from both the right and the left. it gets hammered from the right and from the kind of orthodox religious side for being escapist and violating the rules of the world and getting people seduced by things like magic and power. And it gets attacked from the left for supposedly distracting people from the day-to-day oppressions of real life and becoming more interested in the wizarding world. And I would say both those attacks show how successful and powerful and important fantasy is. Fantasy is about envisioning things that either can never happen or as yet can't happen. And that's very disturbing to any kind of established hierarchy.
Seth Lehrer, yeah. So here's the now Pope going after the religious overtones or implications, saying that they're distorting. When you put this in the vein of Dickens rather than C.S. Lewis, are you
right.
saying that there's not that the moral lessons, if they're here, or the worldview that's presented, is not really an issue of religious concern?
Well, I think for some people it is, but I think religion is a very broad issue in the book. And I think it's really more a question of faith in the self and faith in people. I think, you know, art is a very threatening thing, and childhood is a very threatening thing. And one of the things about the Harry Potter books that I think scare some people is not so much that they challenge specific dogmas or specific religious beliefs, but they present a world in which everything is up for grabs, where doubt is the condition of life. And that's a terrifying thing for a lot of people. That's why I think the books are becoming so good, is that they really are books about doubt.
And I would just add into that point is that they're also about making moral choices and about good and evil. So, yes, Cardinal Ratzinger obviously was not thrilled with Harry Potter, but they have a huge audience among religious people.
Yes.
And they're taught and discussed at Christian schools and among students of mine who are very religious. They love Harry Potter and The Lord of the Rings and other texts. Not so much, I think, because of the supposed, you know, allegorical Christianity in Lewis or Tolkien, but more because this is a way of grappling with issues of good and evil and right and wrong and individual choice versus obedience and all those different themes that modernistic literature, as great as it is, and I'm not one of these people who wants to, you know, throw away Ernest Hemingway so I can read Harry Potter. I want both. But modernistic literature is not particularly good at talking about kind of the big picture ideas of good and evil.
Move beyond those, in a way, existential and all the rest. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Gabrielle is calling from Cedarhurst, New York. Hi, Gabrielle. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I would just like to say that J.K. Rowling is a brilliant author and that it annoys me how people say that they're children's books. Just because a protagonist is a child does not make it a children's book.
How old are you, Gabrielle?
14.
And have you read the latest? Are you into the new book already?
Oh, yes. I read it. I was up till 2 a.m. the day I got it.
And how did it make you feel? Why do you like Harry Potter so much?
Well, it's subtle things like wordplay and puns, and then it's just the way that J.K. Rowling can depict people's feelings, like even though it's something, you know, as outrageous as magic, I can understand it as if, like, I were a witch or...
Sure, and why do you take offense at it being called a children's book? Is there something wrong with it being, if it is a children's book?
No, some children, you know, children's books can be classics. Like, look at the Wizard of Oz series. It's one of the most beloved classics, like, of our time, but... or previous time, but the thing about
all times,
but it's an excuse that adults use to not read the book.
Because they just allow themselves to say, well, that's for kids. Of course, a lot of adults do read it as well. Gabrielle, thanks very much for your call. Seth Lehrer, children's literature is your field. So is this a children's book? Is this part of children's literature or something else?
Well, I think this is the interesting thing about children's literature is that so many books that were originally written for adults become children's books. And a fair number of books that had their lives originally for children become part of the adult canon. The thing that impressed me so much about your caller, though, was how she said she was up till 2 a.m. reading the book. And one of the things that strikes me about all the Harry Potter books is that they're books that stress the importance of reading. If you notice, everyone in these books is in a library. They're reading texts. They're reading books. Let me just mention, you know, my wife went out to Costco and bought The Half-Blood Prince today.
Yeah.
And I have it in front of me, and the very first sentence, it was nearing midnight, and the Prime Minister was sitting alone in his office reading a long memo. Everybody is a reader in Harry Potter. Right. And the thing that I want to stress about these books is that they get people, children, adults, whoever, they get us reading. These are books about reading. And anything to get someone away from the video screen or the Game Boy, I'm for.
Well, that's a broad definition of the worthwhile, but a lot of people relate to that these days. Jennifer's calling from Westford, Massachusetts. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
I love the Harry Potter series. I'm 49. I have a 12-year-old daughter, which is how I got into this series, and I'm an avid fan, and I think it belongs right up there with Tolkien and Ursula Le Guin.
And what is it that you love about Harry Potter? That it absorbs you so, or do you see it as conveying a worldview that you want your daughter to have? Does it help you wrestle with the ideas of good and evil?
Yes, I think it does show the fight between good and evil, and that good eventually wins, but it shows that there is a struggle and that there are moral decisions that need to be made.
Jennifer, were you surprised? You must have started out getting this for your daughter, and now you're clearly into it yourself. Were you surprised when you crossed over and became an avid fan yourself?
No, to be honest, I really bought it for myself when I read it to her as an excuse.
You and
an avid science fiction and fantasy fan for years. Right. One of my favorite authors is Anne McCaffrey.
Oh, yeah, you and a zillion others, I guess. Jennifer, thank you very much for calling. Michael Drout, here's this. I'm looking back, Harold Bloom, writing in the year 2000. Of course, this is the great scholar, a professor at Yale, author of The Closing of the American Mind. He'd only read the first book, but he said, you know, this just doesn't cut it. He said, The Wizard of Oz, for example, possessed an authentic imaginative vision. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone does not, and he gets rougher. He says, Rowling's prose style, heavy on cliché, makes no demand upon her readers. And then he concludes, why read if what you read will not enrich mind or spirit or personality? Wow, that he really lowered the boom on this. Has she gotten better, or do you think that Harold Bloom would come back and make the same critique today?
I would have given Harold Bloom a C- on that essay when he wrote it in the Wall Street Journal back in 2000, I have to say. And also, he's a different Harold Bloom than the Closing of the American Mind guy.
Oh, excuse me.
They're two, but equally annoying.
Alan Bloom. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Yes, that's
but,
right, of
but
course.
But anyway, you know, when we read Beowulf and Chaucer and Shakespeare, we're reading the popular literature of 1,500 and 300 years ago.
Mm.
And it's very hard to tell what we're going to end up taking out of these things and recognizing later on.
Can I add, too? I mean, I would agree with that. And the thing that I would also say is that the books do get better. I mean, she really is learning how to write a novel. And mm-hmm. my feeling is it's the fourth book that becomes a real novel. And
gets better in what respect, Settler?
You know, the sentences are better. There are, in fact, fewer cliches. There's a greater development of plot line. You know, she really is writing with a literary texture. And I would agree, you know, the first book or the first two books are stories in a way that the later books are not. They're novels.
And she's also developed the complexity of her characters, where she's moved away from, just for an example for fan people inside the books, in the first few books you get the idea that everyone in the House of Slytherin is evil,
right?
Because that's why they joined. But later on, we keep getting people like Dumbledore and others saying, you know, the Slytherins are very important. There are good people in Slytherin. That dark side of things is important to defend yourself and to have power. And you could have been a Slytherin, Harry. And that's a sophisticated analysis. Also, the fact that Harry's wand and Voldemort's wand have the same feather from the same phoenix, you know, only two feathers from one phoenix.
But are you ready to stand up and say that one day in the great beyond of the future, readers will look back and read this the way we now read Beowulf?
It's hard to say. I mean, one of the reasons we read the texts that we have is that they were preserved, we think. Beowulf's not a good example of that, but they're preserved because they were popular, so there were lots of copies of them, and many people were reading them. But I would say that we may read Harry Potter 200 and 300 years from now to try to see, as strange as it may seem, to see what it was like to live in the first decades of the 21st century.
What a view that will be. Michael Drout, Seth Lehrer at Stanford, Michael Drout at Wheaton College, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about the Harry Potter saga and the worldview of J.K. Rowling. You can join us tonight. What do you think of the darker turn the Harry Potter books are taking? And is Harry Potter our new literary guide to good and evil? Is that a good thing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Harry Potter, the Harry Potter saga, Harry Potter's place in English literature, and the worldview of author J.K. Rowling unfolding now in volume number 6, selling in waves at bookstores near you. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We've been talking this evening with Michael Drought, professor of English at Wheaton College, editor of the Journal of Tolkien Studies, and from Stanford University, joining us tonight from Palo Alto in California, Seth Lehrer, professor of English at Stanford. He's writing a history of children's literature. We're joined as well now from Dearborn Heights, Michigan, by David Baggett. He's a professor of philosophy at King's College and co-editor of Harry Potter and Philosophy. If Aristotle ran Hogwarts, David Baggett, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So, let's see. Your book brought together the thoughts of a dozen or more scholars on the philosophical threads they found in Harry Potter. Now we're into book 6. I don't know if you've been able to get through it yet, but tell us what's the basic philosophical orientation you find here, and is it evolving? Is it changing?
Well, yeah, I did get the 6th book. I haven't made it through. I'm excitedly reading it about a couple hundred pages in. But yeah, we got together, a bunch of philosophers, and we're all pretty much Harry Potter fans, and explored different angles philosophically of the books, you know, and took different takes, and sort of used the books as a springboard to discuss important questions and issues of philosophy.
And were you trying to suss out J.K. Rowling's own view of the world, or were you finding miniature lessons that you'd applied to many philosophers' work here?
Yeah, we were less looking for Rowling's own personal philosophical views and more interested in using the books as a springboard to introduce people to philosophy and get people talking about important and interesting philosophical questions. And I've heard a little bit of the show here, you all discussing the quality of this work as literature, and I might add to that discussion that one of the tests, it seems to me, of the quality of a piece of literature is its ability to generate important questions and important discussions, you know. So the success of the effort of this book that I co-edited will perhaps speak to this issue, because it has seemed able, Rowling's books have seemed able to generate important questions and interesting discussions.
Give us a couple of examples of important questions you see her generating here.
Well, take Hermione, for instance, in her effort to liberate the house elves.
Of course, and for those who aren't readers, this would be the girl interest here. You got the boys with Harry and Ron, and Hermione's their chum.
Yeah, that's right. And here, you know, Harry's hard at work battling Voldemort and such, and yet Hermione is very concerned about, you know, these house elves that are enslaved and subjugated and such, and we might wonder, well, why on earth, you know, spend your time trying to liberate these subjugated house slaves? You've got bigger fish to fry here, after all. But Dumbledore, who's sort of the exemplar of wisdom in these books, you know, distinctly takes the side of Hermione in this, that it's the right thing to do, and that perhaps it's part and parcel of battling your bigger enemies and opponents that you continue to think about issues of social justice and such. And that's just one example.
And David, when you pick up Harry Potter and use it as a kind of springboard for philosophical conversations, what do your scholarly colleagues from around the country say? Do they say, oh, what a great idea? Or do they say, come on, it's a kid's book. Why are you using it to discuss Aristotle?
Right. I don't think most philosophers have been very critical of efforts to use the medium of popular culture to bring important philosophical questions to a wider audience. So I think sometimes, you know, there's a certain kind of a snobbish mentality or attitude by some, you know, that we shouldn't spend time, you know, using these instances of popular culture as the way to do it. But usually, philosophers are rather receptive to the idea, because they can see the potential, you know, to go to where the people are at and to take advantage of their interest in these interesting pop cultural icons to discuss important questions. And it's worked well with students, you know. As I say, I've taught a couple of courses using our book and a forthcoming book by Tom Morris on the subject, too. And students have really enjoyed it and gotten into it. It seems to engage them.
Ed's calling from Provo, Utah. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have read the book. I finished it yesterday afternoon.
That was fast.
Yeah, my son finished it at 7 a.m. after standing in line for an hour to buy it.
Wow. What do you think, Ed? What do you learn? What do you know in the book?
Well, a series. You know, it's interesting you're talking about philosophy right now, because philosophy means the love of wisdom. And some of the primary characters in this book exhibit that. Hermione and Professor Dumbledore and Professor McGonagall, they exhibit this continuing love of wisdom and learning and finding out the truth, not only about, you know, magical spells, but about a human behavior and human interaction. So I think that's very important, and it is a great springboard for talking about these wider issues.
So do you find your son, are you glad for the life lessons, for the perspectives that he's taking from it? Do you think they're making him a better person?
Yeah, he actually moderates a website in which kids role play as Hogwarts students.
Okay, you've got to give us that web address.
I don't know.
Oh, your son's going to be... Uh-oh.
It's in my scroll-down menu, so I don't ever have to type it in.
Oh, boy. Well, Google it, folks. It's out there. Ed, thanks very much for your call. Let me get another call here. Our time's running down. Blaze is calling from Ashby, Massachusetts. Hi, Blaze. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, our speaker who spoke first, he was talking about how Harry Potter was somewhat like 1930s England.
Yes.
And he said that Voldemort was like Hitler.
What do you think of that, Blaze?
I have to disagree. I don't think he was exactly like Hitler, because his goals were not the same. What I'm getting from the book is he doesn't seem to want to wipe out all the Muggleborns, him being a half-blood himself.
The Muggleborns being non-wizards in the Harry Potter world, yeah.
Yeah, a witch or wizard born from Muggle parents.
Yeah.
And Voldemort's actually a half-blood, which means he had a witch for a mother in this case, and his father was a Muggle.
Well, I thought he did want that, but let's say he doesn't. What kind of villain do you see him as?
I don't think there's exactly like a category for him. He seems to just have like different characteristics than you'd find with most villains. In the book, the sixth book. He is, I don't mean to give any spoilers away, but he's almost described as, he doesn't really, like, have any friends.
Yeah.
It seems that other villains I've encountered in other books seem to actually do have friends.
And so Voldemort, on his own, you put him in a class of his own. Blaze, thanks so much for your call. Seth Lehrer,
yes.
How about it? There's a lot of conversation about how these books are darkening book by book. We heard Voldemort described as a Hitler figure. Right. If you put him in the C.S. Lewis vein, you'd see him as the satanic figure, I suppose, the kind of Beelzebub. Two questions. One, how do you see evil portrayed in this book? And what about the view of the world that kids and adult readers are picking up here?
Well, I think those are great questions. I think the books are getting much darker, but I think, you know... life is getting darker, and you know, as we read these books, she's very responsive to what's going on in the world. I think it's very hard to read these books without thinking of, you know, what's been happening nationally in the past few years. It's a dark world there, and certainly as you grow up, things get dark, and you realize that evil is out there. And I think she's coming, you know, really coming to terms with one of the central questions that philosophers or ethicists or novelists have always asked, which is basically, you know, why do the evil seem to prosper in this world?
And David Baggett, there are, of course, many answers to that question, depending on what philosophical school or religion you might come from. What do you see as the Harry Potter depiction of the relative weight of good and evil? Is this a confidence-inspiring book in the ultimate power of good or something else?
I absolutely think it is, actually. Evil is not at all glamorized here. The books might be getting darker, but evil is definitely portrayed as a weak, sad, poor counterfeit to the good. You know, you've got Voldemort, who is a powerful evil wizard, but frankly, he's also a pathetic creature, you know. And Dumbledore is the real hero here, or Harry on his way to, you know, being in a position like Dumbledore, mm-hmm. with that sort of character.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this in our book, where evil, you know, on someone like Augustine's conception, is a privation or a perversion or a distortion of the good. It's not on an equal par with the good. And that's actually profoundly consistent with the way in which Rowling is characterizing evil in her books as a sad counterfeit. And we'd be well advised to reject the bad and the evil and embrace the good instead.
Teresa's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Teresa. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to call and make a comment. I'm a graduate student in communication, and I conducted a research about a year ago in media effects, interviewing both parents and children who have read the book, and on the values that the children sort of gleaned from the book, what they surfaced.
Okay, from the Harry Potter series. And what did you find?
What I found was actually quite interesting, that children, what they got from the book, for example, the parents treated the book as something that was fun and a mystery and just an adventure, then children treated it as an adventure as well. Whereas if children, if parents talked about deeper values, about friendship and about loyalty, and about doing things for the good of others, in life in general, that was mirrored in the children's response that I talked to. They would talk about this as being the thrust, the general thrust of the book, and being what they got from it.
And Teresa, what about kids whose parents didn't read it, who sort of read it in a vacuum on their own, if there is such a thing, when everybody's reading it? How do they tend to come away thinking?
Well, I only interviewed parents and children who had both read it. What happened, though, is like, if the parents had read it and the child had read it, but they didn't discuss it or they didn't read it together, those values were still reflected in the same
So way. The parents' values and impression of the book being impressed on the children there, them coming away looking at it through that lens, I guess we could expect that. But interesting to think of all these families where both generations are reading the same book. That is unusual. Teresa, thanks very much for calling. Michael Drought, we just got a minute or so left here. Your final thoughts on this book and the kind of legacy it's building in the minds of young readers around the world, the kind of sense of the world that it's nurturing.
Well, I think that fantasy literature is about the little person becoming the powerful in some way. Frodo Baggins has his ring. Harry Potter is the kid who lives in the closet under the stairs. And that's a profoundly empowering idea for individual readers in a world in which that makes us all very, very, very small. We can read Harry Potter, we can read The Lord of the Rings, we can read Wizard of Earthsea, and it gives us this fantasy, and a beautiful fantasy, about accomplishing large things and important things about good and evil. And then what you hope, I think, is that people turn that into their own lives, and yes, they can't go out and fight Voldemort, but they can try to do something good instead of slipping into whatever their temptation is. And that's what I think is the great benefit for these books and this approach and analysis of these important questions.
Well, that along with a rollicking good story, and you've got millions of fans. Michael Drought at Wheaton College, editor of the Journal of Tolkien Studies, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
And Seth Lehrer at Stanford University, professor of English there, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
David Baggett, co-editor of Harry Potter and Philosophy, If Aristotle Ran Hogwarts. David, thank you very much for joining us from King's College.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. In a moment, how children's literature inspired one of the world's most famous scientists. This is On Point. This month, we're bringing you excerpts from notable speeches from the 2005 Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. Last week, we heard from Bill Clinton. Tonight, Jane Goodall. In the 1960s, her landmark research on chimpanzees in Tanzania redefined the relationship between humans and animals. Her pioneering work on primates and jungle ecology laid the foundation for groundbreaking advances in the preservation of critical wild habitats around the world. Her life's work and love of nature dates back to her youth. Here, Jane Goodall describes the key childhood influences that steered her to science, a backyard full of natural wonders, and the fictional adventures of famous animal lover Dr. Doolittle.
When I was a child,
in the house where we still have the house in which I grew up, which is really nice. It's my roots, you know. And it's in a town, but it's got a big garden. It's near the sea. From the bedroom window, you could hear the sea. And in the garden was a special tree. It wasn't really a particularly dramatic tree. It was a beech tree. And I could climb up it. And I used to climb. I took Tarzan books up there. I took my homework up there. I went up whenever I was feeling sad or happy. And up there I felt, you know, closer to the birds. And so I would sit there and... the tree's still there. I can't climb it now. It's grown. I can't get up the trunk without a ladder. But it's still there. And I think that the tree, the animals... And I had this passion. Dr. Doolittle really had, I think, a huge impact on me, because although I knew I never would speak to animals like him, I wanted to. And I pretended to. And all my friends thought that I was. I would pretend I could talk to the squirrels, and I'd make the little sounds, and I'd translate for them what the squirrels were saying. And so I had this long fantasy time when everybody else thought I could speak to the animals, even though I knew I couldn't. But it gave me an awareness of, you know, how the animals moved, so that I was making probably a very good interpretation of what they were feeling, if not saying. And certainly people are always saying to me, you know, how can you be so peaceful when you're in the middle of, I don't know, some crazy book signing or airport or something like that. And I think it does, that peace of nature, particularly the forest, all the years I spent at Gombe, it does get inside you. I only have to close my eyes and I can be in the forest. And that is a peaceful place. But the last piece of the corollary is, if one has a reasonably well-developed brain, and mine's reasonable, you know, I did well at school and passed exams, so it's a reasonable brain, and we learn from experience if we have a reasonable brain. You know, like rats getting lots of shocks, learn not to do it that way, but to do it the other way. And I learned very early on, when I came out of the forest and began talking to people like the professors at Cambridge or journalists or whoever it was, that if you start being aggressive and angry and pointing fingers, you actually don't get very far. And that isn't the way to change. If you want people to change, you've got to find a way of getting into the heart.
Jane Goodall speaking at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, and Alan Kukul. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.